Sudbury is itself an accident in a way. A meteorite happened to hit Sudbury. There happens to have been mines here. There happens to now be a snow at the bottom of this mine.
So the fact that snow is here is because there is a deep mine here, and it's in Canada. And Canada has basically strategic stockpiles of heavy water for the nuclear power industry. So the realization in the 80s by some extremely clever guys who were looking at, you know, the solar neutrino problem and how do you solve that problem, there was a realization that one of the target materials that would be extremely valuable from the physics perspective, because it would do something that no other detector could do, is heavy water. You try to achieve your physics in the easiest possible route, and the fact that, you know, heavy water's in Canada and you have deep holes means that it's a natural marriage. And then, of course, you've got to persuade people that, we won't lose your kiloton of heavy water worth $300 million on ISGOV. Yeah. Lend it to us and we'll put it 2 kilometres underground in a mine, in a cavern bigger than anyone has ever dug before, in infrastructure that is cleaner than anyone has ever made before. But don't worry about that. Yeah. We're scientists. Trust us. We have quite a broad program, but it focused on two key areas. One is dark matter and one is neutrinos. So dark matter is, we know from astronomical and cosmological observations that we don't know what the majority of our universe is made from. And so one of the postulated solutions to this is a new type of subatomic particle, and that's what we're searching for. The neutrino is a subatomic particle that we know exists, and we are trying to understand both the intrinsic physics of that particle, but also the physics of sources. So the sun gives off a lot of neutrinos, the Earth actually gives off a lot of neutrinos from nuclear reactions inside the crust and the mantle. The supernovae give off huge amounts of neutrinos. So we have programs here looking at both the nature, but also the sources of these particles, types of particles. So if you understand that you need to build a detector which has to be sensitive to a certain, if we put it in terms of rate, we know that we anticipate one dark matter interaction in a ton of detector material, perhaps every year, or less. So that's the sort of level that these detectors are being specced for. So that means that from the physics perspective and the detector's perspective, okay, that's the detector that we need to build. To do that, though, we have to make this thing incredibly clean. So everything has uranium and thorium in them. We have to build a detector that is made from materials that have been purified or don't have uranium and thorium and potassium and any naturally radioactive material in there. And this is radiation at a very low level. So the sort of radiations that we're referring to in our detectors are well below the sort of levels that you're being bombarded with all the time when you're on the surface. So as you sit in a concrete house, you're being hit all the time by gamma and radon, gamma radiation and so on from uranium, thorium and radon. It's relatively organic how these things develop. There will be people around the world working on a certain technology. There are people around the world working on liquid argon that you are aware of because you are part of that community, and you will draw these people together into a large collaboration, sufficiently large to attract the funding and get the job done. It's an organic process because there's no, we don't have a phone directory that says, if you want to look up who knows the best about wavelength shifting at minus 115 Celsius or whatever, you don't have a telephone directory to do that, but you know people who have been involved in that because you're aware of the community. Underground science is not a huge community, and these projects become very expensive very rapidly, and so there are only a few number of collaborations that will move forward just because of the scale.
Among the many individuals that work at SNOW, there are also individuals whose task is to clean.
Yes.
Very microscopic dust. Yep. That seems fascinating to us insofar as it reminds us how that most infinitesimal piece of dust actually can jeopardize all of the work. Could you talk about what it means, literally and philosophically, for the work to be that, let's say, codependent on others, but also what it means for you to have to manage both the research but also that imperative process.
To get the science done, you have to work in a certain mode. And so for the scientists involved in Snow Lab and Snow, there is a recognition that if you want to do this sort of science, you have to have incredibly clean detector systems. And so, you know, there is a clear recognition that, okay, if I want to pursue this sort of science, I have to develop detectors which are within these constraints of cleanliness. And that refers to, you know, the intrinsic radioactivity in the material, but as you're referencing, the dust that comes in. Mines are obviously not clean rooms, and yeah. Creating a clean room in a mine is a very challenging task. Maintaining a clean room in a mine is probably a more challenging task, because you are then dependent on this mutual acceptance that, yes, I will operate in this mode for the common good. For Snow Lab, we have to export that to several, you know, we have 7 projects working underground, some of whom are, one might deem, competitive in the sense that they're searching for the same sort of processes using somewhat different technologies. So you have to work in a mode where, you know, you recognize that for the benefit of everybody, including yourself, you are going to work in a certain way. And that means you're not going to bring in, you know, dirty materials. You're not going to, you know, skip washing your hair when you go through the shower, stuff like that. So the management of that is partly psychology, because you need to make sure that people buy in to this concept that you're going to follow the rules, because the rules are there for your own protection in terms of the science that you're doing. It's partly technological, because we obviously monitor the state of the environment, but a whole bunch of it comes down to the elbow grease that people put in, like the cleaning staff. So, yeah, they are not obviously not practicing physicists, so they have to take our word for it that, you know, if we throw a gram of dust into the detector, then that detector's dead. Right, so they will take that on faith that that's what the physicist is saying, and therefore the cleaning that you need to do is at such a high level to remove any contamination or any dust in the area that, you know, we get people to buy into that model. The reality is, of course, because it's the cleaning staff that maintain the facility, they are the most aggressive in maintaining the cleanliness of the lab. So if they see somebody doing something which is unclean, they will be the first to comment. Right. From the cleaning side of things, it's not so much formal qualifications we're looking for. It's a frame of mind. It's the ability to take on any job required to maintain the cleanliness of the lab, and do it with a thoroughness and a dedication which is impressive. You know, go through Q-tips and clean out cable trays and cables, and touch every single surface underground and make sure that it's absolutely pristine. And that dedication then translates into an environment into which we can deliver science.
Maybe this sounds like a peculiar question, but clearly you see them as part of your team. Do those scientists that work at Snow also see them as part of the team?
Yes, yeah. I mean, they see them as part of the Snow Lab team, because they are essential to undertake the research that they want to do. So it's completely interrelated, completely interlinked. I mean, it's, you know, the Snow Lab team operates as a team because it has to.
There is no alternative.
Right? We just have to work in an environment where there is just complete connection between all of the different components of Snow Lab.
Perhaps this is not something we want to talk about, but can we talk about this mine worker who died yesterday, which means not only that someone's life has been lost, but also Snow is basically kind of closed until the circumstances of that get negotiated and resolved and security protocols get addressed. Snow Lab seems at once kind of this space, as you said, of extraordinary imagination, and at the same time a precarious space.
One of the requirements of the delivery of the science, but also, of course, the delivery of the business of valet, is that you have to be underground. So from our perspective, we, of course, as valet do, make the operation as incredibly safe as possible. There is bound to be, you are 2 kilometres underground, there is bound to be an element that you cannot factor out. But generally, it's an environment where there are some intrinsic hazards that you have to be cognizant of, which is why the health and safety of the organisation is one of the paramount, one of the key strategic statements that we make, is that this is got to be a safe operation. It just has to be. And so one, you're talking about reconciling the different facets of the operation, and that is one of the aspects that you have to reconcile. That when you're underground, you can easily lose sight of it, because the environment that we've created is nothing like a mine. One can lose sight of the fact that you're 2 kilometres underground, but one has to recognise at all times that you are. There are intrinsic issues that brings to bear.
But that risk has always defined your practice. I mean, in West Yorkshire, in South Pole, you've always been in these extreme spaces.
I think that's an illustration of the... I mean, that's the challenge of getting the science out, that to do envelope-pushing science, you need to push the envelope. And to do that sometimes means that you have to put yourselves into extreme environments to undertake that research. Of course, the objective is to make sure that extreme environment is a very safe, very safe place. In terms of my, as you say, in terms of my career, I've been to some pretty wild places, right, to do the research. I would characterize it by saying that the most dangerous time that I have is probably going to Rome to give collaboration or to give talks, and getting in a taxi and driving around Rome. Right? It's a question of environment. It's a question of hazard mitigation, and you recognise that you're doing these things in pretty wild, extreme environments, so that you take great care to factor out all of the hazards that are possible to do so. One then is left with the residual hazard that you can't. But again, it's the you have to reconcile that, and you have to reconcile it in the knowledge of the steps that you are taking. And that is one of my key roles as a director, is to make sure that the staff are working, and the visitors, and the scientists, and the students. Right? I mean, you have a duty of care to everybody who comes to Snow Lab, and you have to ensure that you are taking every step possible to ensure that they are working in a safe environment and working in a safe way. I think when you send your kids to college to do a PhD or whatever, I mean, you want to know that they are working in an environment which is well maintained, well controlled, and even if it's not intrinsically 100% safe, it is 100% safe from the efforts that people put in. So it's always put in context with the events of yesterday, which very tragic. But one has to reconcile these as people do.
How would you define your practice? Do you see yourself as having a fixed practice, or is it more of a perpetual process of negotiation?
Yeah, there's a negotiation in terms of how you do things, what you can do, and of course when you can do it. So it's a collaborative movement in that sense. But ultimately, of course, there are these constraints that you hit up against. So I have to take responsibility. I have the duty of care to people coming underground, and if somebody wants to do something that I deem, or more realistically, we put all of our experiments through very rigorous technical, safety, operational reviews to ensure that they're consistent with the guidelines that we have. So if somebody wants to do something which is out with those boundaries, then it doesn't happen, and they have to go back and come up with a different way of doing it. So, yeah, interesting place. Yeah. Fixed boundaries, not just from not just from the rock, but from other aspects as well that you have to contend with.
Can you talk about what you understand authorship to mean? I know that there's the authorship that takes the form of putting a name first or second on a published peer-reviewed paper, but it seems that what you're speaking about is a highly collaborative form of authorship.
Particle physics is sufficiently... sociologists have studied particle physics collaborations because they are sufficiently weird in the sense that it works. And when you think, okay, what you're going to do is get all these scientists together. Yeah, scientists have egos as much as everyone, as anyone. People think that they know better, and the best way to do these things, you get several hundred or even thousand of those people together. How do you get these egos to agree on the best way forward? How do you get them to develop these detector systems in the knowledge that there are several hundred other people involved in it as well, and their idea may not get picked up or whatever? Particle physics is a huge construct. So you actually have to develop agreements about how you will make decisions and how you will come to a conclusion about what technology to select. So there are fairly detailed, simple, because they're not legal documents in the sense of...
It's a social contract.
It's a social contract. So this is how the collaboration is going to work. We will have we'll have a project spokesman or a project deputy spokesman, and these are the responsibilities they have. We'll have this is a long-winded way of getting to the authorship, but we'll have a publication committee which will look at all the papers that get written, make sure they're of sufficiently high quality, make sure everybody agrees with it, make sure the authorship list is correct, and then you'll have basically governance committees within the collaboration to determine how to make changes to the constitution, all these. So it's a very complex structure, but it has to be, because these things take many years to build as well. Mm-hmm. So you are talking about several hundred people spending, CERN is the ultimate example of this, right? I mean, you're spending billions of dollars, $1 billion a year to operate CERN. You've got tens of thousands of people involved in the operation locally, hundreds of thousands of people connected around the world.
You can't afford to allow it to be about one person.
You cannot afford it to be a dictatorship which just goes in that whim, goes with the whim of that person. So the authorship for particle physics, which makes it unique, is that it's alphabetical. And that is generally dictated within the constitution, that if you have a major results paper, if your name is Arneson, as it was for the W discovery paper, then that's great. If your name is Smith, for instance, and you're in particle physics, that's not so great. So I don't have too many first authorship papers, as an example, but the community knows that. The community recognizes that as well, that they would be alphabetically authored.
How do you encapsulate that within that economic sort of narrative?
Standard example here is we started the impact study with actually KPMG here in Sudbury, and the guy that I phoned up to start about it, he sort of said, before we start, I want to know, do neutrinos travel faster than the speed of light? Because my 14-year-old son has been bugging me ever since he knew I was going to talk to you. I think, okay, great. So we then talked about neutrinos for an hour and economic impact for 5 minutes. And that's the beauty of the inspiration, is that you are capable of couching things in terms of the wonder and the mystery of understanding the universe and trying to put it into a framework which we can then understand and move forward. So putting it bluntly, what floats most of our boats is the understanding of the universe around us, rather than writing economic impact analyses. We have to do that to get to demonstrate the value in a wider context. To me, one of the strong things, though, is this inspiration agenda. There's nothing quite like connecting with people, showing them the wonder.
So how do you encapsulate that within that economic sort of narrative?
It's actually very difficult, because and it's something that science has struggled with over the last decade. This is the director in me speaking, right? Because over the last decade, you've gone from technology transfer, wealth creation, and now it's economic impact. It appears subtle shifts. It's actually huge shifts in what that really means, because obviously technology transfer is what widget can I build that I can then get people around me to sell to make money and create jobs. Technology transfer is one of the mechanisms that you can use to justify the value of science. I'm a particle physicist, so I should be able to write down on any grant proposal to any government, I invented the web. Well, we invented the web. Right? Give us the money. Because that is a transformative technology. Right? And that was particle physics solving one of its problems for data management, data manipulation. But in doing so, Bernard Lee developed this widget which has just transformed business around the world. Can't imagine what it was like 15 years ago now when you can sit in your bath and book your holiday online. Just unbelievable. That's just one angle, which is the widgets that you're going to be demonstrating or going to be building. And the difficulty with that argument is always, the web, that's so 80s, right? What are you going to do for us now? And that's a very difficult problem to look at, because in science, what technology is derived from fundamental knowledge is always difficult to understand. So one of the connections with these neutrinos, for instance, is that to use a GPS in your car, you actually have to code that GPS with both the general theory and the special theory of relativity. That's an illustration where something that appears completely arcane and pointless when it first comes out, who really needs to understand what the implications are of travelling faster or close to the speed of light? Nonsense. 100 years later, it's absolutely instrumental to the ability to find your way around a foreign city.
So what you're saying in a way is that, like, of the many things that Snow Lab does, it also incubates the discovery of, let's say, knowledge in ways that might be unanticipated, or...
This is very much technology, in terms of the technology spin-out. Yeah, in terms of the knowledge that we get here, it's impossible for us to say, next year you're going to be driving around in cars that are running on dark matter, right? Because that's not going to happen. Start. But you don't know where those technologies, you don't know where that knowledge is actually going to lead fundamentally. So when you're making an argument about technology transfer, it's actually quite difficult, which is why people have moved to this economic development position, that there's a recognition that it's not just technology that we create. It's not just the widgets that come out and the theories that might have impact 20, 30, 50 years down the line. It's the people that are fundamental. And the people are the inspiration of the next generation of engineers, the next generation of scientists, the next generation of mathematicians. That a lot of that is down to things like particle physics and cosmology and astronomy, where people are just blown away by the wonder of the universe and want to learn more. And they then become not necessarily the next generation of research physicists, because it's a very small community, but the next generation of entrepreneurs, of innovators, of people who do a lot of that technology development. The much broader economic impact numbers. Notwithstanding, I mean, our own analysis shows for snow, every dollar of provincial money put into snow, we generated $9 of economic activity locally. And that's a really strong argument as far as the local environment's concerned. Got sort of sidetracked onto the economic, the economic impact side of things. But the inspiration, I think, is one of the critical aspects that does get people interested in science and interested in telling people about science, teaching people about science, becoming science communicators, and so on.
In the cultural sector, there's this word urgency that we constantly invoke. There are urgent and compelling reasons to respond to the tensions that define the society that we live in. Like, how would that be a word that you would use, and what would it mean in your context?
Absolutely, I would use that word. I think the science is very collaborative, but many scientists, I think it's fair to say, are quite competitive in the sense that they want to be the ones who understand it first. Competitive is not quite the right word, because we, yeah, everybody works at this. It's one of the wonders of the scientific community, actually, that people are open. I mean, everybody works on peer reviews. So you find, you know, when you write a paper, it's your erstwhile competitor who is actually reviewing your paper, right? So it's an amazing construct. This is very strange, the more you think about it. So it's a very collaborative process in that it's totally open. Once things have been completed and you've got the data running and so on and so forth. But there is a huge amount of pressure and tension to ensure that you are developing detectors quicker, more aggressively, better systems than other people around the world, or other collaborations around the world, I should say, because you know, all these things are international. You know, people want to demonstrate that their idea has got better legs than somebody else's idea in terms of pushing the envelope of the sensitivity or whatever. So, you know, the dark matter world is a classic example where there are many dark matter detectors around the world. Every very deep hole in the world has a physicist in it, many searching for dark matter. And that's because it's such a fundamental question at the moment in terms of contemporary physics, in terms of contemporary science. You know, this is one of the real challenging questions that people are trying to address. Extremely difficult, extremely challenging. But the payback, I should backtrack, because we don't actually know that the thing that we're searching for exists. Right, so this is what's generally known as high impact, but relatively high risk research, because it's somewhat speculative, but it's grounded. I mean, you wouldn't get money if it was just, yeah, this is my theory of dark matter, right? You get money because there's a whole community which has developed theories which mesh so beautifully. And yeah, that's the other aspect is I'm an experimentalist, but I'm driven by the beauty of these theories that people construct. So if you look at the dark matter world, you have the confluence between astronomy, cosmology, and particle physics. Cosmology is the study of the largest scales possible. Particle physics is the study of the smallest scales possible. And dark matter ties all of these things together extremely nicely.
I have a somewhat different question. We don't know how to ask this of you. From the cultural perspective that we occupy, we're often thinking on the level of like the human, on an intimate scale. Our brief experience of snow back in September and the months since reading and thinking leads us to think that you think on a cosmological level. Is there a tension there for you guys, as there is for us when we try to negotiate the scales of the cosmological and the human? The temporality at play in the research that Snow's doing is completely different than the temporality that we experience on a daily level. Well, how do you negotiate, either personally or philosophically in the work, like the human in relationship to the cosmos, let's say?
The fact that we know... we know how a supernova blows up, pretty much. Well, we don't actually, but we know enough, right? We know the processes. We know how the sun burns. We definitely know that very well. We know the age of the universe is, you know, whatever it's 13.5 billion years, based on measurements of the cosmic microwave background and galactic evolution, motion of matter in the universe. So. From a physics business end, one certainly gets used to working on timescales which are outrageous. Yeah, they are just outrageous, because 13.5 billion years, you have no concept of what that actually means. No one does. And you just have to reconcile that. I think this is where astrophysicists should be humble. Because, because that is just it's an illustration that you don't want to over-egg this, but you are sitting on a small speck revolving around a pretty average star in one galaxy out of many, many hundreds of millions of galaxies that exist. So it should be humbling in that regard. That doesn't stop you Yeah, wanting to get up in the morning and get out there and solve more of those problems.